Hello, everybody. Welcome to Ask Anything. It is fantastic to be here with you. And we have a special treat today. We've got Susan Baum, our regular goddess of bright and quirky education. And joining us today is Zach Morris. And I was telling Zach that we were talking on Tuesday in our coffee, telling people he was coming, and we had all these like excited hands. So Zach's like the Justin Bieber of our world. And Zach specializes in kids with PDA, kids who have experienced trauma, kids who are, I think of Zach, like, let's call Zach on the red at phone for our underachieving kind of stuck kids. And he did I say, yeah, underachieving, and he's so good with these kids. And then Susan is the chancellor of the Bridges Academy Graduate School, and as you all know, is our expert on TUI education. So let me check in with you both. How are you doing? What's going on before we get started? Susan, what's new in your world?
Oh, it's been really exciting. I've been spending more time at in the school. We had Henry Winkler come and talk to the kids yesterday. He is so inspirational. He
Hey.
is so good talking to these kids. If any time he's speaking where you can take your kids, do it. He's just amazing. So yeah, I've been down at doing things like that. It's fun to get back with kids and fun to get back talking to teachers. But now I'm home finally. I can use that too to catch up. But Henry Winkler, he's a guy. He wrote a
Wow,
new
good
book.
to know.
He has a new book, Henry. It's called Henry. It's a autobiography. He really, his journey as a dyslexic young individual when absolutely no one understood dyslexia. And he was called stupid. Like sounds like Jonathan Mooney in a way. Dumb, stupid, lazy, and how he just kept to his dream, and how he still
Amazing.
needs to have partners when he writes all these books. He does it with someone who writes. He's the author.
Fabulous.
So navigating life, being neurodiverse, and doing it so beautifully, he presents such a great model for our kids.
So cool, so cool. Zach, how are you and your world? And maybe just a quick introduction for anyone who is new to you.
Yeah, I'm well. I'm also back where I normally am in Montana. I was in Chicago last week for the PDA North America conference, and it was really great to be in community with everybody, right? And just have people be feeling so seen and heard and in connection with other people who are navigating similar things. And so I'm feeling super inspired coming off of that, and always nice to just sort of be with our people, right? And so that's kind of what I think so much about with this group, and just so grateful to be here and that you offer it. And yeah, for anybody who's not familiar with me, I am a education consultant and family support worker, and my business is called Alive at Learn. I've been working with autistic individuals, PDA families, for over 10 years in the educational sphere. Have been in the classroom in anything from traditional public school to inner city charter school to co-op homeschools to independent private school models. And so now I'm helping families navigate all the complexities of that with what they're navigating. So thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
All right, fantastic. All right, you guys, we're going to get right into our questions here. Sue, starting with you. My son will only read the same books over and over and over again, so much so that the spines wear out. It is also becoming a problem in school. How do I get him to explore fiction and other topics? And I just have to say, this triggered me right back to Diary of a Wimpy Kid. That was like 10 books were read over and over and over again in our house. So, what do you think, Sue?
Well, my granddaughters, who are avid readers, like to do that too. They like to read them again. Now, you don't want them to get stuck there, but somehow they just like reading those words again, whatever that story is. A lot of bright kids do that. You said, how do I get them to explore other fiction? Are we thinking that some of what they're reading is not fiction? And I'm not
Sounds
sure.
that way. How to explore fiction and other topics.
Yeah, and I think that what we do, if the nonfiction draw is science, or then you would want to go to science fiction. But the non, if it's something to do with history, then you want to go to historical fiction. And one way to get them to do it is to challenge the book. Is this scientifically correct? Is this historically accurate? Let's see if we can find, and so they get to visit their nonfiction world, which they love, as a critic to the fiction world. So I would encourage that approach.
Okay, fantastic. And today I have a feeling we're going to be mentioning PDA a lot, which is pathological demand avoidance. And it's not a diagnosis here in the States. It is in the UK. And Zach, would you say that our kids who would normally fall in like the oppositional defiant or sort of uncooperative, or is that like the umbrella of kids that you see that related to PDA?
Yes, very much so. Often, yeah.
Okay, great. All right,
And I,
just wanted to define that. Yeah.
yeah, and I wanted to jump in on that first question too, if I can say something as well,
Please.
because I had some ideas kind of coming up. One of the things I wanted to mention too, and kind of, echoing what Sue was saying, is like these repetitions in that may just be very much kind of just a part of this person and their nervous system and what like helps create some regulation and comfortability in some way, right? So just knowing some of those repetitions with the same material may just really be a part of that. In terms of it, inspiring and encouraging, like exploring, fiction and other topics, I just think about strewing and modeling. Right, leaving some things out in some ways, right, without drawing too much attention to it, seeing if maybe it gets explored on their own in some way. I also think about trying to bring that into possibly some different venues. So maybe they're not super interested in exploring a different, book to read that's in the realm of fiction or something like that, but maybe they're open to checking out an audiobook while we're driving in the car, and we might be able to get into something that's a little bit different, because now it's just a totally different venue. It's almost like we're in a totally different situation than like how I normally am doing my reading. So just a couple of thoughts that were coming up for me.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say this idea of strewing is genius. We have a, like a running joke in our family. If I ask the boys, do you want carrots? Do you want apples? They will always say no. If I just cut it up and put it in front of them and don't ask, they'll eat the whole thing. And often same with, so just strew it. Just leave it out there and don't even ask them.
Yes.
Okay, good point. Good point. Zach, here's the question for you. I noticed a pattern through three generations of my extended family of bright and quirky kids being bright and sociable until about puberty, then switching to insular PDA mode throughout adulthood, causing some to lose jobs and many to lose roommates or friends. Is this an undiagnosed disease process? And are there treatments that can be done at puberty to save them from a lifetime of PDA?
It's a great question. I interface with this a lot. I see this happen a lot, actually. And the first thing I want to kind of mention is just sort of orienting around PDA for a second, and maybe shifting our thinking from like a PDA mode or sort of falling into PDA, and really just seeing this as a type of nervous system, right, experience that someone has. And so a lot of how a lot of us are looking at PDA is it's a profile of autism, right? And so it's not that necessarily like now I'm dealing with PDA when I used to not be, right? I may be PDA, right, in some ways, and it might just be manifesting in some different ways than it used to manifest, right? And one of the really hallmarks, right, of PDA that we're looking at is this demand avoidance, right? But that's also not the only aspect of PDA. So for some of our really like more internalized, profiles of autism, some more internalized sort of manifestations of individuals, there can be such higher levels of masking. There can be such fawning responses. There can be so much of this that in earlier stages of life, when also There's not as much social complexities. I'm not dealing with as much on a physiological level because of just hormonal changes and all of those things. That it's not uncommon at all that we can sort of really see some big shifts sometimes for these kiddos when we get to 12 and 13 and sort of that age and stage. And all of a sudden we do see some new resistances coming in, or we do see some new avoidance, or just literal changing in the experience that I'm having and how able I'm able to keep myself regulated. If I'm someone that's been in a high masking or high fawning place, I might have also just fatigued by this time. I might have been able to kind of do it until now. I can't. I fatigued, right? Sometimes we see this at 8. Sometimes we see this at 10. Sometimes we see this at 13. So not uncommon, and really maybe looking at what this is talking about with this nervous system and neurotype. And demand avoidance is something that we can see in lots of profiles. And that can just be also a manifestation of stress and disassociation and some of these things that come out of that hard experience.
Exactly. And we talk a lot about polyvagal theory here. You guys, I'm going to the Polyvagal Institute conference this summer in Germany. I'm so excited. My
Yay.
sister joining me. And this is, we talk about green zone, where we're open, ready to learn, ready to engage, red zone, which is fight or flight, and blue zone, where we shut down. So a lot of times when we see our kids shut down like this, especially in teen them, it's a stress response, like you're saying. So it doesn't have to be full blown, like this child meets criteria for PDA. It could be a stress response. Okay, great. All right. This one's for both of you. My son with ADHD and suspected dysgraphia will be moving over to middle school next year, seventh grade. And we are planning to build a 504 plan this fall. If the middle school can accommodate his needs, do we need an official 504 plan? And does he need one anyway to continue through high school and college? And I'll just define for anyone joining us from Europe or other places today that this is a 504 plan is an individual education plan while the child's still in the classroom, not pulled out from the classroom. All right, who would like to go first?
I'll take a stab at it first. It's always, I don't tend to worry about a plan if if people can accommodate kids in the classroom by doing it because they just differentiate naturally, because that's who they are, and they happen to give kids choices, that they encourage kids to do their writing using technology and not handwriting. So if that's what they automatically do, then it's a happy place. But if it isn't, I think teachers need to be reminded, that we have a child here where not giving a choice could be problematic. I need to pay much more attention to it. So again, if it's a kind of setting and environment that is more choice oriented, then I wouldn't worry about it. But if it isn't, 504 is always helpful. It always is able to clarify things, make people clear that your child should be really familiar with what it says and learn how to advocate for those things that are in it. Because teachers get busy, teachers forget, teachers get distracted. There's also, and it's not that they don't want to give the accommodation, they just don't think of it. So if the youngster can work out a deal with the teacher in ways to remind that teacher what that child needs to be successful, that's just a bonus, because they're going to have to do it in college. They're going to have to make sure to take care of themselves. So no good time to start now in middle school.
All right, great. Thanks, Sue. Zach, what are your thoughts?
I echo a lot of what Sue's saying. I also think, it may become relevant as we get to high school or get into a different setting, right? And maybe the accommodations aren't quite as built in and all of those things. So it's not something that we necessarily have to, I think, get set up now. for later, right? Like that may be something we can address later. It might also just complicate things trying to go through that process now if I don't really need it and things are actually working out. And that could be really confusing for the student in some ways, like why we're exploring this whole process, right? And I really like what Sue's saying of just really getting to know, like, what are those accommodations that are happening for me and how do I experience that and how does it work and what supports me, right? And as a parent, I might be just also cataloging these things too for myself so that if we find ourselves in the next school environment and we are needing some of these accommodations and supports, I also have some clarity around what we're advocating for.
And to add to that, I mean, it's really a little bit off, but Zach reminds me right now at Bridges, I'm really working with parents who don't really understand what kids need to transition into college. Everyone is always so worried. It's probably the most anxiety provoking situation that parents face, especially if the child has been in somewhat of a bubble or we've been accommodating for them. They're so worried. And in their mind, the best thing we can do is get them to do more work, hand in more homework, write more papers, and then they'll be ready. And it's just the opposite. And Zach reminds me, they need to go to college clear on what they need to be successful, what works best for them. And so that's for, and how to advocate for themselves, because in college, you can get that support. You can pick subjects that you don't have to do a lot of writing. You can take the writing subjects and spread them out over different years. So it really is important that kids build that self-awareness. I'm not stupid. I know how I can be successful. This is what I can do that gets me successful. And this is the support I need. And if we do a good job with that, things are going to be much easier in their whole life making better choices.
Okay,
Yeah.
wonderful,
And
wonderful.
gosh, I want
Yeah.
to piggyback off that one more time, because if we think about the accommodations that are going to be so unique, right, for our child that are going to work, right, just to even put this in concrete terms, it's like I work with kiddos where more time on a test or more time on an assignment, more time on an assignment is really helpful. I also work with kids where more time on an assignment just means longer anxiety. Right. So that's where some of these accommodations are going to be so unique. And that's why I love what Sue's saying of like, how do we really help our kids get to know that so we know what really works for me and I can advocate for that.
Love it. Great stuff, you guys. Okay, Zach, my 8-year-old son with ADHD and dysgraphia broke his tibia last week. All he can do is lay on the couch and watch TV or play video games. He's in too much discomfort to go to school and can't manage crutches easily. His sleep is terrible. How can I best help him manage screen use versus trying to encourage him to do his homework or read, given he probably can't go to school for several more weeks? He's resisting, and I don't want to cause more pain and suffering for him, but also know 8+ hours of Netflix can't be great for him either.
Yes, this sounds like, right, likely a really big life event for this individual, right? Like, yeah, breaking my tibia at this age, right? Like, gosh, this is maybe really impacting so much, right, of what I'm able to do, and therefore some confidence and competencies, and like you said, just navigating just pain and discomfort. And so I say that because I feel like I can't overstate that enough, just like that how big of an event this maybe is, and the recovery and repair time of it, right, being like a really unique process. And so I think about when we think about like getting to homework or reading things, right, I think like oftentimes that's really associated with like our need for learning or our need for challenge, right? But like in this time of repair and recovery and really even just reconciling and processing what's happened to me and what this means for my life, right? And all of those things, my needs for learning and challenge might just not be super relevant for me, right? They just might not be what I'm really seeking out. And so as I really look at, what might be the really relevant needs for this person, it may be rest, it may be ease, it may be autonomy, right? Like these might be taking much bigger priority for this person in terms of what the actions they're taking, right, in order to meet these needs. And it might just not look like some of those those other tasks, right? Those assignments or home or reading and things like that. And the last thing I'll kind of say is even when we, because if we think about reading and I think about that through like my own experience, I might see how like, oh, reading meets my need for rest. Reading meets my need for entertainment, right? But it might not meet those needs for my child, right? And that also might be why there's maybe just not a huge draw there. This isn't even speaking towards who knows, and I don't have this information, but where we were at leading up to this, I might have just been feeling like I was getting really exhausted and fatiguing and maybe even approaching a burn. Who knows, right? And now I'm just really enjoying this time also too. And I'm feeling like a whole newfound just level of comfortability in myself. So that's kind of what I think about. I also think about that idea of like, I know long term over time, 8 hours of Netflix, likely not super serving for someone, right? But I also think about in the short term, I don't know. I don't know if that's not necessarily not great for him, right? I think there's a lot for us to kind of explore there.
I
Yeah, I
think
think I'll just go ahead, too.
But I know what you're worrying. How are they going to make up the work? They can't. You've got to negotiate with the teacher what the minimum is. Compact curriculum compacting. Do they really already know it? So we really don't have to make up the work because they really do know how to do those math problems. They don't doesn't matter if they didn't read that novel, their life will not end. Start off with the next novel and skip it. Or what project can I do to show that I've mastered what I've missed? Because this makeup work, this is another thing I've been dealing with lately, is so anxiety provoking, especially if kids are somewhat perfectionistic. And the more they see that they have to make up, the more they freeze. So, along with taking a sabbatical from school, what does re-entry look like? And it needs to be comfortable, and they need to be able to ease back into it. Otherwise, we'll have more of a catastrophe.
I'm snapping. That was amazing, Sue. Perfect. I love that.
Okay, great. And I'll add my two cents too. We were just talking about green, red, and blue zone. And when you are really ill, when you're in pain, when you're in discomfort, you're in the red zone. And yeah, so I think to give us, like you were saying, Zach, our kids, the rest that they need while they are in the red zone. And if he's home 2 or 3 weeks, it's not going to all be red zone time. Maybe the first week is red zone and then we get more comfort. If we ask them on a scale from 1 to 10, how much pain do you have? Once that decreases, then we can start talking about, okay, what do you think is a reasonable amount of screen time to have? How about how much entertainment time versus education time? You could do a lot of learning about cool hobbies on YouTube versus, trashy stuff on Nickelodeon or whatever. But I have a bias. My kids are like, Mom, I can't believe you didn't let us watch SpongeBob. We feel culturally deficient. But getting into the screen time content that we talk about, what are you choosing to watch? How much are you choosing to watch? Strewing those offline activities, jigsaw puzzles, art projects, science projects, it'd be a fun opportunity to get into all that stuff. All right, this one's for both of you. Moving cross country and school district shopping for an autistic, twice exceptional, almost 8-year-old. His biggest school struggles are school refusal, eloping, which I think means running away from school, and non-participation. Any tips for evaluating potential new public schools for a good fit from a distance?
I'll
Class
yeah, go ahead, Sue.
size. Class size is a big one. When I'm looking for any school for a child, it's really imperative that whatever my child loves, if it's art, or if it's science, or if it's animals, that school happens to have a good program in that. That there are pets in the classroom, or that there's fish that they can take care of, or there is a science lab in that school, or they have a really good art teacher, because you got to have a way for that child to connect to that school with other people who like the same thing. And then I look for the kinds of support that they offer and the flexibility of programs. So,
I always think of you, Sue, when this question is asked, support the gifts and interests first.
first.
The supports for challenges come second. Yeah.
Yeah.
Zach, anything to add?
Yeah, you know, I it might be like a step here before this, and but I'll get to this too. Is you know, I just start to wonder, right, about the school refusal, the eloping, the non-participation as well. And I get curious around what's also maybe catalyst for that or impacting that, right? So this is going to maybe lead me to get curious around sensory sensitivities, what the environment is like from sort of a sensory perspective, from an offering perspective, from a menu of choice perspective. So these are things that I might be curious about first, kind of with my own kiddo and trying to identify some of those things. But then as I sort of talk to the school and want to know like how that classroom's set up and, you know, are kids expected to sit at group tables or do they have their own spaces? Like are there different, you know, chair options, right? Like things like this that maybe are going to help me understand if this is going to support the sensory needs of my kiddo. And also looking at the opportunities, right? Of like, do I, if we're given assignments in this class, do I have the option of doing it in a little bit different of a way, right? What happens if I'm not willing to do that activity? Like how is that sort of handled in this school environment, in this model? These are all things that I would want to know.
I totally agree. And I think there's a precursor to the question of which school is right for my child, which is what was the root cause causing the school refusal and the eloping? There, we really need to get at what that root cause was, because we want to treat the fire, not just the smoke signal. So let's do some really deep research with the child, with the school staff, to say what was, and if you guys haven't seen my emotional regulation roadmap that we did last month, Casey can put it in there. You know, this stuff, the signals you're talking about are like a child who has a peanut allergy eating a peanut and then has that swollen face. So these are like the swollen behaviors. So what is the equivalent to the peanut that was causing these symptoms? Okay. I'm not sure which of you would like to answer this one. Our son, 10 years old, homeschools. He plans a schedule for each subject and homework. But once the time limit is reached and he's asked to move toward another subject, he either ignores the request or gets angry, making a snide remark. How can we assist him to follow his schedule? Any book, presentation? And I'm going to ask the question, starting with Sue, like, and do we need a schedule that has end times if we're homeschooling? What are we looking at here?
Who thought of this? Whose idea was it to have a schedule?
All right, do we have this parent here? If you would like
Well, it does
to.
say, I think you said he plans the schedule. I think that's what I heard, but
Well,
Yes, you're right.
at whose request? I mean, if someone said to me, plan your schedule, now I arbitrarily make a schedule, or, you know, schedules, I mean, depends why he gets annoyed about going to the next item. Is that child really in flow and so absorbed in something, or is he so cognitively rigid that he can't, you know, change the subject order? So, you know, there are certain things we would want to know, because one of the worst things in a school is when the bell rings and you are so engaged. I think about little kids. You know, our whole goal is for us to get kids to sustain attention while they're being productive. I don't mean in front of a computer game or screens, but when they're really engaged and they don't want to clean up their toys that they're building with Legos because it's bedtime. It's almost the worst thing in the world when the kindergarten teacher says, it's going to be cleanup time now, let's sing our song, when they are really engaged in something. And so we're our own worst enemies when, on the one hand, we want them to sustain and produce and create, and then stick to an arbitrary schedule that's convenient. So
I mean,
ask.
Sue, could we? Yeah, I'm just wondering, could we be flexible in the moment and say, oh, it sounds like you want today to be a block period. You want a longer time with that. We could say yes, but then tomorrow's going to look different. It's
Or say,
something like
let's
that.
say, right, or saying this schedule, maybe you really want 30 more minutes in it. You know, the same thing. And maybe you didn't, maybe each schedule subject shouldn't be the same amount of time. Or maybe we want to reverse the order because you don't want to, once you get involved in math, you don't want to do anything else all day. So why don't we play around with that schedule so it works better? And maybe there's another issue, and maybe that's more for you, Zach, but maybe just hearing someone say stop triggers that negative behavior versus, you know, I'm ready to stop. So maybe it's setting an alarm or setting another way to say, my time's almost up with this. Or if you need more time, I need 5 more minutes, set the alarm for 5 more minutes. So there's lots of little things to try if we have a better idea of what's the problem with the schedule and who is the one who needs the schedule.
Yeah, no,
Yeah.
that resonates so much, right? And even just starting in this place of, yeah, like what's driving the schedule, right? I work with so many kids where I see this constantly, and it's just an overcommitting to a schedule because I just think I'm also expected to do that many, right? So I'm just trying to answer the question, and I'm like, yes, I'll do it this way, but then I of course get into it, right? And I have a different experience with it, and so I think that I so resonate with that idea of getting some clarity around like what's driving that schedule, right? And I think more than yeah, that priority maybe being like helping a system and following the schedule, this sort of I think what we're talking about of helping explore how that schedule is experienced and if it's meeting my needs, right? And sort of looking at like we might be trying to help this student understand like what I'm actually seeking out or what happens for me when I do get into flow state here, and even though I kind of made this plan, and like, and what does that basically mean for me? What, you know, and what we might be also talking about is routines. Routines and schedules are also different. It might be that I'm actually trying to build some routines,
What?
but I'm just taking that through the lens of like building this very specific schedule, and this happens at this time, and this happens at this time. And maybe I'm actually really interested in the idea of like, well, you know, I love that routine of the first thing I get into in the day is the thing that's like top of mind and I'm feeling really excited about. And then, oh yeah, in the afternoon, I kind of do that thing that's I want to be working on, but I know is a little harder for me to get to, right? Like all of a sudden, we have so much flexibility in times or where things are happening. And so we might also be exploring routines in addition to just schedules.
And personality has an awful lot to do with it. Unless I'm really busy and I really need to get a lot done and check things off my list, my kind of mind really, I need to do what I feel like doing at the moment, not just do it because I made an arbitrary list. And I only go to that mode if I really need to catch a flight or something and I need to check things off. But basically, you know, just because I say I'm going to do this right now, and if I'm not in the mood to do it right now, it's a stupid thing to even try to do. I'd rather switch something around and decide each day, what do I want to do right now? You know, so it's making a schedule is much more comp. We could write a book, Zach. Why don't we write a whole book on how you schedule your life? That would not be fun.
Love it.
I love this conversation because it's so true. And I think, I mean, there's so much richness in this topic because really we're learning life skills, we're learning self-awareness. And this is the joy and beauty of homeschooling that we can look at personality. What time of day do your best work? How much time do you want to put into your preferred subjects and your non-preferred subjects? Like, it's okay if you're not well-rounded and we spend half the day on STEM, you know, a little less on everything else. This is the beauty of homeschooling. And it may be also that parents' style, who might be very structured, maybe they're an engineer, might really be uncomfortable with flexibility. So it's experimenting on both sides. All
Yes.
right. Cool discussion. All right, Sue. My bright and quirky daughter is 14, has dysgraphia, dyslexia, ADHD, autism with PDA. My question is about dysgraphia. How much time should we continue to spend on the remedial tasks of practicing cursive and spelling versus prioritizing proficiency in typing and voice to text? Can she really get through life without being able to handwrite a legible note or spell? How will she take notes in high school and college? Background, she worked with an OT, kindergarten through second, was in a school that used Slingerland, cursive and dictation through fifth. And now we homeschool and spent all of last year doing Wired for Reading, which just about ruined our relationship. She's creative with a large vocabulary and lots to say. Words come easily to her. They're just next to impossible to get down using handwriting. Oh, that's a perfect question for you, Sue.
You can give my answer. I mean, doctors don't write legibly. When I'm thinking, I don't write legibly. Forget it. Throw away the pencil. When they need it, they'll grab it. Because sometimes you don't want to type it. Sometimes, right? And you can dictate into your phone messages. You can dictate. I mean, this whole idea of handwriting at 14 is too oppressive. It's just not worth it. If they didn't get it earlier, find another way to get your ideas on paper.
Okay, short and sweet. Love it. Love it. Okay, for both of you, my profoundly gifted autistic 12-year-old girl has been struggling in her new school, and she's been demonstrating negative behaviors at school, which we haven't seen before to this extent, such as shutting down in class, answering back, holding classroom door closed, and not allowing the teacher into the classroom, calling her peers rude, privileged, and idiots or unclever, leaving the classroom for frequent bathroom breaks. Some of her peers resent her because they don't know she's neurodiverse. She doesn't want to share this and thinks it's unfair that she gets away with stuff that they wouldn't get away with. The educational psychologist who assessed her 2 years ago says that these might be impulsivity and demand avoidance, which sometimes shows up in autistic kids when they hit puberty. Is this a thing? Or might it just be a bad fit school thing? These did not come up in any earlier assessment. How do I set her up for success in her new school, which is smaller, class size of 11 instead of 25, and allegedly gets bright and quirky kids? I feel traumatized by the current school who promised support and didn't give it, and I'm finding it hard to trust the next one. Thank you. Who would like
Yeah,
to
is that
begin?
I'm just trying to make sense of this question too, in the sense of if they're still at this school where this is happening, and asking kind of like how to
Yeah.
make it work there, if they're going to a new school
I
because of.
actually know this family. I think she's in her last couple of weeks at this school and is soon going to start at the new school.
You know, my sort of initial thoughts are that we may need a period of some decompression, possibly in some way, right? Like the things that I'm hearing here, and some of the manifestations we're seeing, this is telling me this person's definitely seeking out safety, right? There's some definite overwhelm happening in some of these moments.
Stress
And
behaviors, right?
what's that?
Stress behaviors.
Yep, stress behaviors, totally, right? So this is where like I'd want to just also, even before I'm looking at what school is gonna again set us up for success, how do we advocate for that? I'd really just be wanting to know so much more of like what's happening for this person, what are we able to notice like on a somatic level, what are we notice is like happening for us inside of these moments, what's happening maybe when we like are thinking about some of these moments, right? Because yes, age and stage 12 years old, lots of changes happening, lots of changes in the body, right? There could be so much that I'm just feeling flooded and overwhelmed by. And it might not even be too much of like because of the structure of the school or anything like that, that I'm just experiencing stress and overwhelm with things that I'm not totally sure how to navigate. And then I find myself in moments where I'm really needing some extra autonomy. I'm really needing some extra spaciousness. I'm really needing some extra gentleness. And maybe it's just not there for me in that moment. And I'm panicking. And I'm just trying to get back to safety in some way. So I'd want to know so much more about what's happening for this person, so we could advocate for those things in the next environment, so we could know what is impacting some of this.
Zach, you've talked a couple of times about autonomy. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and unpack it a little bit?
Yeah, meaning like, and I think it's tied to like our need for control at times too, right? And this really comes out under times of high stress, right? And overwhelm and being flooded is that as I maybe lose that sense of control, or I lose that ability to choose for myself and really like impact my own experience from my choices, I might just feel myself longing for that even more, right? So all of a sudden, I'm like, feeling flooded, about to start this class that I'm not really interested in. I don't feel super connected to this person, and I'm just wishing I didn't have to interface with this teacher right now. So I'm like keeping them out of the room, right? I'm just trying to exert some autonomy because maybe it's not an option for me to also just like leave that classroom and go connect with like someone in the school that I actually can feel safe and comfortable and connected with. Like if that was maybe an option for me, maybe we would be seeing a different manifestation. Maybe we wouldn't see the door getting closed, right? So I'm kind of wondering, like, what's this person longing for and trying to seek out in those moments that they don't have access to or don't have support around? And are we able to actually support and give access to that?
Got it. Thank you. So
Where is that safe spot for that child? When are they not acting that way? That's always in when do we see, a different person? I think it's really important that there's enough time in the day where someone feels really safe. If it's helping the school, the administrative assistant with attendance, or going to the library, reviewing books, or where are those moments of safety? So, yeah, it's
Yeah.
to be integrated
Right.
into that space.
Wonderful. Okay,
Can I
great.
say one more thing too? I,
Please.
because the talk of safety then was sort of pinging this for me, where I was thinking about, I see the seeking out this need of safety in what we're hearing. And I'm also wondering about just this need for connection that, like, again, I'm thinking about like all the name calling of some of these peers, right? And some of these things. And that's leading me to think like, I might not feel super connected to these people. I might not really feel like held in a peer group in some way. It could be that I'm starting to notice I'm thinking about and paying attention to things that are really different than what my peers are thinking about and paying attention to, or the things that I really value and care about seem to be really different than what these people value or care about. And that might just really impact also my sense of belonging and my sense of connection, right? And I think this is really tied to also that safe space, right? Sometimes we have that actual space where we feel safe. Sometimes we feel safe like in the environment because of also just connection and belonging.
Good point. Good point. Next question. I read recently that 8 out of 10 adults with ADHD have experienced trauma. It's very sad. Why do you think that is, and how can we prevent that for our kids?
I have a thought, but do you want to start, Sue, or I can jump in?
Now you can start, then I'll jump in.
My short answer is mostly like the world has not been set up to support the needs of these types of nervous systems and neurotypes, right? That like so many structures of the world celebrate like people that are having different experience, right? Or really like open doors for people that are having different experience, right? So that's kind of like my short answer, is that just like this complex trauma experience, like over time from just interfacing in ways where I just don't feel seen or heard, or interfacing in ways where like that's just not an option and I have to like mask or do it differently in order to get through it, right? So I think a lot of it is just really honestly the structures of how school is, how work is, how relationships are set up, like all of these things.
Yeah, and just to talk about some examples, I mean, if you're a kid, in any given week, let's say you're a wiggle worm in class, you might get that look from the teacher. Why can't you sit still? The note home, how many of our parents, like, they see that number on their phone, they're like, oh, it's the school again. Or the child has maybe done the homework but not turned it in, or maybe they couldn't get started on the homework, or maybe they were acting sillier than their same age peers and they couldn't find friends. I think, like you're saying, if you're in a school in a world that wasn't built for your type of brain, these behaviors that might be completely fine if you were homeschooled or with people who are similar with you now seem like outlier behaviors because you're in a certain structure and it's full.
And our kids are very sensitive. So what might be embarrassing or shame them is people would say, well, why did that even bother them? You know, people, but it does bother them. And even if the kids are really bright in ADHD, I mean, they might ask a question that that nobody else even is interested in, or the teacher said another time, and they keep being put off. And they're very sensitive to what's happening around them, and everything has the potential to be traumatic for them because it goes on over time, and it builds and it builds. So all these little subtle things that people don't even understand is an issue builds up and builds up. So I agree, it's the environment can be causing so much of this trauma, and we just need to be much more sensitive to what our kids need in any particular environment. I love the work of Tom Armstrong and his positive niche construction, that we don't tell the flower to change its petals because it's not growing. We plant it in another garden where the petals are the right kind of petals for that dirt. And, you know, I'm so much more about creating better environments, you know, both external ones, so the internal ones will be better as well.
And I think also, you know, the mind is a meaning-making machine, and helping kids understand you're not broken, you're not a failed version of normal. Your brain is wired very uniquely, and you're in a certain environment that doesn't match it. It doesn't mean anything about you being less than. I think Jonathan Mooney calls us different, not deficient. And
It was interesting because Henry Winkler said, just because you learn differently has nothing to do with your brilliance. That there's so much brilliance within you, no matter which way you learn. And he was so good with those kids yesterday. He says, hold on to your dream.
Oh, I love that. And Sue, we were talking yesterday about one of your graduate students studying adult neurodivergent people with alcohol abuse. Can you just tell us a little nutshell about that?
So she was interested in, bright, she was always worried about kids being bright, not getting their needs met in school. And one of the things she worried about, if they didn't get their needs met in school, did they turn to things like alcohol? Because research has shown that when you're looking at alcoholics, there are many more alcoholics of bright people than not. And there was a lot of studies done in England, and it really got her thinking. So for her dissertation, she wanted to look at some bright 2E or neurodiverse bright individuals who I started drinking when they were still in elementary school and early high school, but who have since turned around. And she was looking for, you know, schools, you know, just gave them work that was too easy, which was part of it. But what she really found with this sample was that every one of them experienced trauma. And trauma ranged from disappointment to perhaps abuse and death in the family. So, you know, it ranged the gamut, but every single one of these individuals had that kind of story to share. And I was telling Debbie what came out for me, which was a surprise. And the way I like to think about the world, I love this finding. So they did turn around because they're not drinking anymore. And she gave them a couple of personality tests and traits, character traits, and looked at their sensitivities and their talents. And those positive traits, coupled with their desire to pursue their talent, pulled them out of the alcoholism. So I, you know, and we want to get more data on this, but this was really a surprising finding, how often they said, I really wanted to go to law school. I wasn't going to get accepted if I kept drinking. Or I am an artist and I really want to pursue my art. And I can't do it this way. And so that and it wasn't one of the questions that prompted it. It just kind of came out by itself. So It's, we're just finished analyzing the data now, and I said to Debbie, we'll get the final model in a couple of months.
That'll be fascinating. All right. Thanks,
Well,
guys.
can I say one more thing?
Reviews.
But just to and to come back to this, what you were saying, Sue, about it, just like building over time too, right? And this sort of leading to this trauma, and as we think about that in the case of in the environment that we're in, right? And I'm thinking about how sort of the relationship between also like patterns of my neuroception, which I'll explain neuroception here in a second, but of and how that can sort of like contribute to some of these like trauma experience that I see as well, which is that like neuroception being like our body's surveillance system, right? This is what like in a split second tells me whether I'm like safe or in danger, right? Under threat. And so what can happen for some of our kiddos, especially when we're like under stress and chronic stress, is that neuroception can become inefficient. I can perceive threat when there's not really a huge threat in some way, right? And again, this can be to some of just even the sensitivities that some of us have. We just might be more apt to perceive some threats when there might not really be threats, right? So if every time I'm showing up to this class and I'm every day I see that face from this teacher, and I translate that face to mean my idea's bad, I'm not doing it right, I'm not good enough. Over time, every day, over weeks, over months, like this is the stuff that also leads to trauma, right? In some way, some
Yeah.
complex trauma there, right? That now I'm also, gosh, I might see that even a version of that face from someone and already go to that place, already have that sort of trauma response, right? So this is why I think that environment and how that environment's being experienced over time is so crucial to kind of understanding how we end up in some of these places or not.
Well, I really appreciate this conversation because also a lot of our kids going through this don't have the words for it. And I think us parents equipped with this knowledge can ask questions about it, and it's really, really important stuff. All right, thank you guys. Zach,
Yeah.
what do I do when school doesn't accept PDA characters and says your child needs to learn to be in society and they keep triggering him and he is developing chronic anxiety?
Cue our trauma conversation, right? Like I think
Right.
like the short answer, and it's a really hard to hear message, and I know it's not convenient for parents, and this has to do with resources and opportunities and all the things, but my short answer is move on. Go find
Move
some
on from that
people.
school.
Yep, move on from that school. If I've already been trying, if what my experience is like, they don't accept this, they're not listening, they're not curious about it. I've been trying to advocate. Again, this is the stuff that can really lead to trauma for you as a parent and for our kiddo, right? So I think this is my hard to hear message is often that's sometimes the time to seek out some different support, a different environment. Of course, right? That's a super personal decision of when you arrive at no longer willing to pursue this. I don't think it's actually fruitful. It's not really serving us. And so I think that can be a trap that can happen for us when we're trying to support our bright and quirky kids, is trying to continue to get support from something that we're not actually getting support from. And so again, that's a very personal decision of when that precipice moment is, you decide to sort of seek something different out. But sometimes that's the really hard to hear message is we may not be able to get them to accept it. And we only may be able to get support and our needs met through something different.
And in our possibility plan course, step six is advocacy at school. And we have a whole decision tree on deciding when to work through the system and when to call it quits. And
Yeah.
it's very difficult journey, but I think this is where you get your mama or papa bear on and advocate like crazy and find the right environment.
Yeah, and what I would and other thing I would sort of say if we are still trying to advocate, because right, you might be in that space like where we are still trying to advocate, and that's totally okay, right? That I find if we can be talking about more nervous system experience and how that impacts the learning brain, and we stop talking about PDA with someone that doesn't want to hear about PDA, that can be, it's almost like that term can just trigger that people's nervous system where like, oh, we're not going there, it's not in the DSM, like talk about the same thing through a very different lens. How can we be talking about anxiety? How can we be talking about the shutdown experience in the nervous system? How can we be talking about how the nervous system experience is impacting the learning brain and what we can do and can't do, right? PDA is so much about can't, not won't.
Right. Good point. Good point. Okay, Sue, question for you. I find myself stressing about what the future holds for my 8-year-old who should be in grade 3, but is currently not motivated to do his grade 2 work at all. He covers about 5 minutes worth of work per day. His challenges are PDA, dysgraphia, and potentially ADD. Even when I link the work to his interests, he does not want to do it. He's currently at a tutor center with 5 children in his class, and he doesn't do any of the work. I'm scared he will never be able to use this intellect and will never go to university. I also feel lost in terms of where to start helping with his list of challenges: ARFID, dysgraphia, sensory integration, academically behind, social challenges. And Sue, before you answer this sort of global question, I'm just reading between the lines here, and it feels like a neuropsych assessment has not been done yet because that level of clarity isn't there. So I would say step one for a child like this, we really want a solid neuropsych assessment. And then, Sue, I'll hand it off to you for the actual question.
So what, children work. Children work all the time. You just don't call it work. And especially before they go to school, they're working at playing with their work is playing with their toys. Their work is it depends on organizing their books. Some of them do that, or lining up their cars. They have work. And so I want you to ask yourself, what work does your child do? They have make decisions, they choose to do things, and that's their work. Now, just because and I think the biggest block for your child is writing. Because when they go to school, if all their work means fill out a worksheet, color in these lines, learn how to write your name, do a timed math test. And that gets to be called work. Certainly, it's not joyous. Certainly, it's not productive. And it does not mean for 1 minute that your child is not learning because they're not producing the work. Unfortunately, they're learning good things and bad things. When they sit in circle time and they're talking about the calendar or what holiday it is, I would be surprised if your child doesn't know it and hasn't learned a lot of what they talk about in school. Just because they don't put it on the worksheet doesn't mean they're behind. You didn't say if they're reading. Did it say dyslexic or dysgraphic?
We had dysgraphic. Let me see. Yeah, I'm just seeing dysgraphic.
Right. Maybe they're reading. Boy, if they're reading, they sure are learning. They sure will be. This is developmental. There could be a lot of asynchrony involved. There's a lot to do with. I just think that when work is equated with how much you put on paper, it could be the biggest problem. And I would have to look at that first. Because I do think, are they building with Legos? Have they made something with Minecraft? Have they created songs and music? Where is their work? What are they doing?
Wonderful. And I also want to say, just coming back to my comment about the neuropsych assessment, is this has a flavor of ADHD, and the gold standard of treatment is medication plus coaching. And it's a personal choice for families. I don't even know if this child would meet criteria for ADHD, but ADHD medication can have the equivalent effect in one day of like putting on eyeglasses and being able to see. So I just want to really encourage you to get that evaluation too. Okay,
Yeah.
Zach.
Yeah, just to piggyback off real quick, because I
Yeah.
love what Sue's saying, right? It's like rather than linking the work to the interests, how do we just pursue the interests and discover the work that is already relevant to them inside of that, right? Because what we really want to try to avoid is devaluing learning in our attempts to value school.
Right. And certainly not to make the everything they love being part of their work. They need
Exactly.
to choose it. We can't say, well, you can link it to your interests because then they won't ever give you their interests again.
Exactly.
So you say, what did they do? What did they? So they're talking all about they if they really like I don't know what they like at 8 years old anymore, but or if they like Pokemon or whatever they're liking, you have to understand, wow, they can express themselves. They can tell you a story. They can do cause and effect. There's inference there. It doesn't have to be because they produce something on a worksheet.
So true, so true. And I have to say, Colleen put in the chat, for this parent who's not sure where to start, also try the possibility plan. That really puts you on the roadmap here. So maybe Casey can put that in the chat. All right, guys, we covered no, one more question, and then we will have a little bit of time to cover questions that came in on the session. Okay. My 8-year-old ADHD dyslexia PDA is homeschooled, and I feel he needs some kind of activity to channel his energy and also a place to connect to peers. However, anytime we try an activity or a sport, he feels triggered by his instructor or teacher. Therefore, he lashes out and usually won't integrate with the other kids. What can we try, or should we even try this right now? Zach, do you have thoughts on that?
I do. Yeah, my first thought is that we might it kind of brings me back to autonomy. We might try an environment or activity that fosters more autonomy and more autodidactic learning, like meaning being able to teach myself, being able to sort of explore myself, right? I worked with all kinds of students when I had my school, right? It was predominantly autistic PDAers. And so you can imagine trying to bring people into a class or a course or things like that, right? It was really challenging. And so I used to take students to the open gym at the parkour gym. That was a lot more successful than a class at the parkour gym, right? Because students could go and they could explore and they could do their own thing and they could be around people, but nobody was saying, hey, time to do this. Right now we're gonna do shift over to this, right? So I think this was great for students that weren't able to access or interested in accessing like direct instruction or structured classes, but still wanted to participate in something, still wanted and needed to move their bodies. And so this is stuff like open gym, this is stuff like maker spaces, this is stuff like open swim time, bouldering at the rock climbing gym. Like, what's that thing that I can go get involved in where I don't actually have to be led through instruction?
Hands-on science museums are really a great, they get all these activities you do yourself, and then you see another child doing it, and you start talking together.
Yep.
Wonderful. All right. Question for Sue. How do I know when I should test my 10-year-old for dyscalculia? In my experience, having a test result doesn't always help navigate giving my kids the tools he needs.
I think any time the child isn't learning and you're wondering, it's a good thing to ask for an assessment because it's just as important to rule it out as rule it in. And it really helps you make decisions what to do next.
And that
So
would be someone like Dr. Dan, his group, the Summit Center, clinical psychologist who tests for learning disabilities, right? Okay, great. Dan, we're thinking about you in spirit. All right, question for Zach. I am my 9-year-old PDA son's main squeeze, as my husband says. He says the mean things to me, blows up at me, but also tells me he loves me, he's sorry, etc. My husband, however, gets nothing from him. It is so hard. Affection is so rare from my son to my husband. What can we do as a family to help encourage my son to open up to his dad as he does to me?
I'm just thinking about this sort of sense of safety, right, that this person feels with the mom in this sense, right, which is that's often, such why we see, right, getting the like hardest stuff and getting the best stuff from them, right, is like they feel so safe with us, they feel comfortable, right, like they know it's okay to sort of be in that space, right, and so the way I'm making sense of this is for whatever reason, right, when I with dad, I just don't have that same sense of comfortability, that maybe that same sense of safety, right? I'm a little bit more maybe apt to sort of perceive some of that threat. And so I think this would be the space to get really, really curious, on sort of the dad's end about just like, what does this look like when we're in interaction together? What does my tone of voice look like? What does my face look like? Right? Like I've often talked about having to like put my stage face on it sometimes, right? Because if already there's a little bit of that dynamic between kiddo and dad, already it's just like the moment we get into the same space, I'm already not at baseline a little bit if just that dynamic is established. So I might already be more apt to like perceive your neutral face as kind of aggressive, or I might already be apt to like just not totally be tracking some of that voice because now my ears are literally priming themselves to focus on lower frequency sounds, right? So I just don't hear it as much, right? So this might be where I might have to be really trying to, in some ways, like communicate this air of safety, to just over time sort of work that. This is going to be really like probably a slow shift through just becoming more and more safe. And part of that is going to be, so we're talking about like attunement and responsiveness. So when I also come to you and I am sharing something, is it okay? No matter what it is, whether it's positive and desirable for me or undesirable and hard for me, like, can you hold it? Can you hold it? And I'm not perceiving value judgment. I'm not perceiving disappointment. I'm not perceiving, right? Like, it's okay for me to be having the experience I'm having. That's really gonna grow that sense of safety, I think.
Yeah, and I would love to see some family connection time, maybe a family game night, family special time where the child gets to play and he might say, Mommy, I only want to play with you. But you say, you know what? Oh, right now is family game time. So we get that comfort as a family, whether it's playing a board game or wrestling or Legos or playing charades. And then maybe that's just slicing it a little thinner than just hanging out with dad. And then I think for men who are especially very blue, with very deep voices, maybe he can sit on the floor when he's talking to your son, have a little bit more of a sing-song voice, send those signals of safety. And then once we get past feeling a little bit safer as a family, and I know this is a homeschool child who hangs out with mom a lot, but let's give mom some time to go to the gym and meet friends for dinner and walk and say, oh, it's going to be your special time with dad. What do you think you might want to do? Do you guys want to go out to dinner? Do you guys want to, make science experiments in the kitchen? Stuff like that.
Yeah, we might need to. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Sue.
It might be fun to take lessons together. That's something that might be hard for dad too. Like we're going to learn to go rock climbing or something that dad can't hasn't done yet either. And we're learning together, and dad can be not so good at it at the beginning as well.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, that can be a great place of sort of leveling the playing field, right? Increasing that sense of safety. I also think about sometimes we might have to just sort of stack the deck in terms of the interactions that dad and kiddo are having. So it just might be, for some time, I'm just maybe not the person that can be asking about brushing teeth. I can't, because we need to be stacking the deck right now, that we need to be having this many more really comfortable ease interactions than also some of those other moments, right? This is something I notice even just like between me and my partner and my kids, right? If someone comes back after they've been away for a little bit, it's like you can't just start asking, doing the hard stuff, right? It's like, oh, I'm not gonna maybe practice, because we got to rebuild some of those good, comfortable, feeling good, situations together to maybe even have access for some of those other
Gotta
things.
have a laughing time. The old song for that everybody has a laughing place. You've got to laugh together. And you can even have a laugh, I don't know if the sensory issues or whatever, but just by forcing everybody, we're going to laugh for 5 minutes and everybody fakes it first. And before you know it, you're all laughing together. And just, it's got, this is where being silly is a good thing.
Oh, I love it.
Happen
Family
to
comedy
watch,
movie night.
yeah, or
Yeah.
something has to be silly and funny and having a pillow fight or something that can't get too aggressive, I guess. But just being silly and funny and,
Yeah,
Yeah,
love it.
play is
It's
such a communication of safety. Let's play. Yeah.
Okay, Sue, I have an 11-year-old autistic ADHD who has a high verbal IQ and comparatively low math skills. Despite a lot of practice and efforts, he has not mastered times tables and is shutting down from frustration. My mom worked in intervention and has suggested at this point he should probably just be using a calculator. I would welcome your thoughts or ideas.
I always think they should use a calculator if they understand what math means. So if they, multiplication. So if they can use manipulatives and show you that, to 8 times 4 is 8 groups of 4 or 4 groups of 8, and they can do that and play with that, then let them have the calculator. I would hate to have them do it if they don't know what multiplication really means. Or they could have fun. You could say add 8 4 times on the calculator. Now let's use the calculator and say 8 times 4. Ah, same answer. So if you play with it in a way that, and if you keep using the calculator, sometimes they memorize them that way because it lights, you're pushing the button, you're saying it's multi-sensory, 8, and then you push times 4 equals, and you're kind of saying it, it lights up in green. And before you know it, you don't want to be bothered pushing the buttons anymore. Oh, I remember that from last time. 8 times 4 is 32. So yeah,
Wonderful.
go to the
Wonderful.
calculator. Yeah,
Okay, great. Zach, a
I
couple last questions for you. Oh, did you have?
sure. Well, I was just gonna say, I was just like taken back to being in like middle school myself, right? And I was like, remember being told I couldn't use the calculator because I needed to learn this because what happens when I don't have a calculator? And here I am this many years later, and I've never not had access to a calculator,
Yeah.
right? So
yeah.
and
So
if you
true.
really don't and you have to figure it out, you probably figure out a way
Yeah.
to
So true, so true. Okay, Zach, my 6-year-old son, autism level 1, has aggression issues when he doesn't get what he wants. Door slamming, scratching, kicking, punching, etc. His brain gets hijacked and he only sees red. 15-minute outbursts, followed typically by contrition and crying. Any suggestions on how to navigate this?
This is super tough. The externalized manifestation is so hard. I can't overstate that enough. So just like, gosh, my heart is feeling for this situation, right? I think I'm I get we're likely going to have to find ourselves in some more negotiation than we wanted to. Right. I think that's sort of the thing about like boundaries and limits and some of that stuff, right? Is they're as helpful as they are accessible in some ways, right? So if it's not accessible, if it's leading to this like patterned meltdown and this is just continuing to happen, it's getting longer, like it's not actually even resulting in the thing that I was hoping for by like having some of, right? And of course I understand there's bounds to this. This is not a message of like just give into your child and give them everything, right? Like, but this is a mechanism of like we may find ourselves in some more negotiation with our child than would be part of like traditional parenting, right? Because again, negotiation is where we're also going to find this place of safety. It's where we're going to find some collaboration. It's where we're going to also learn like what's actually sustainable and accessible for this person or not. Of course, would be so many details for me to know about this in terms of like what the day-to-day looks like, what some of these demands are, right? But we may be talking just needing to create a more low arousal environment overall, meaning there's we are tuning into those things that are really arousing and dysregulating for them. And we're just sort of structuring and scaffolding our life where we're not interfacing with as much of those so that in those other moments of a boundary or a limit, it's maybe more, I'm more able to navigate that and interface with that.
Right. And I want to add to this, definitely want to point you towards the emotional regulation roadmap we did last month. Casey's putting the link to that in there. And I can't stress enough how important it is, not in the heat of the moment, as I like to say, strike when the iron is cold, to do some Ross Green style collaborative problem solving to say, hey, buddy, when these things happen, you have these behaviors that are not safe for other people, and we need to have a firm boundary that these unsafe things can't happen. And I want to brainstorm with you other things you can do when these feelings come up. So very important to brainstorm a cool down plan.
Yeah, and in I love what you're saying, Debbie, because in that regulated space too, right? That's where I can also check in and go like, do we even share the same reality of like that this is happening, right? Where I can go to my kiddo like, hey, I notice like this happens kind of in this moment. Like, do you notice that too, right? And maybe they're like, yeah. And I'm like, I'm just, what's that like for you? You know, it seems right. And we might be able to get in and share this reality that like that's a situation we both want to avoid. Like we actually both have a share a common goal, which is like we both don't want to get to that space. And now all of a sudden we're in some of that collaboration that you're talking about.
Okay, we're going to end with a very spicy question, which is, how does one de-escalate a teen who threatens violence? This seems like a very scary warning sign. And Zach, maybe you want to dive into this topic. I just want to say that safety is paramount. And when we have a teenager who we can't simply pick up and, put them in their room and say, hey, whether you cool down alone or I cool down with you, it's time to cool down. And the fact that they are threatening violence, which is premeditated, I think I like to tell you guys when this is sort of out of the scope of the ideal lab, and I do think local help is needed for self-regulation tools. And also, there's got to be some unresolved anger here, potentially unresolved trauma. So we do want to get some very good clinician. We might look at EMDR, CBT, but we want to get that on board at home. All right, that's my medical caveat. What would you like to say, Zach?
No, I echo that. And I mean, this is definitely the time to be building a team in some way, right? I think, I mean, this is where we're maybe even looking at sort of like crisis intervention services that might be in our community if we're needing to call upon some people and but we're not trying to call the police necessarily, right? Because we want some people that are skilled to navigate this in some other ways, right? So we might even be talking about some of those things, especially if I'm needing to remove myself. If I'm needing because I'm needing to make ensure my safety, right? So there's kind of two parts here is like we're talking about my safety as a parent, but also my child's safety, right? And so I think the biggest thing we're also thinking about is we're not trying to add stimulus that's exacerbating it in these moments, right? So this is where actually we're trying, I think, to take actions and scaffold things in a way that are again, not backing this person into more of a corner, right? Not creating even more threat because that's where maybe some of this is even coming from. It's coming from a place of threat, right? Perception, all of those things. And so I think this is absolutely the time to get more people involved on the team, talk to other professionals, all of these things, and really make some plans for ourselves of like, this is the script that we're gonna have under some of these situations so that you're not also improving as a parent in some of these moments. Sometimes we might be dealing with some of these moments like very much in the moment and we're needing to take some actions and you can imagine we're all in a nervous system. So you're maybe not going to be thinking as clearly. You're going to have so many responses online. So really developing your kind of crisis plan and script for how you're maybe going to be navigating certain situations. And what we're setting up and scaffolding to try to avoid some of those situations.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Zach. And I would be thinking of a collaborative conversation along these lines when we're not in the heat of the moment. I would say, buddy, I don't know if you realize that you are a big, big person now. And when you get angry or when you say that you might be violent, it is very scary to other people. I know that you're a good person inside. I want you to have a beautiful life. I know you want to have a beautiful life. But if we use this sort of technique to try and get our way, it's not a good way of saying it, but use this technique to, solve problems, I'm scared that you're going to have an anger management problem, like in your own home, when you have your own kids, when you have your own family. And I know neither of us want that. So this problem is bigger than we can deal with right now. We need to bring in some people. I can find three people and you can choose one of them, but doing nothing is not one of the choices because we're talking about safety. So something along those lines, and then do your research, bring in the people. If you want to ask a question in the Facebook group, do a little more problem solving about which helping professionals in your community to call in. We can certainly help you with that. All right, we got them all answered in the time frame. Heavy stuff, interesting stuff. Thank you, parents, for bringing all the juicy questions. Sue, Zach, this is the point where I ask you for any closing thoughts. And my closing thought that I will share is I'm just happy I did that emotional regulation roadmap last month because there really is a way to navigate all of this anger, irritation, frustration, opposition, and it's all in there. So if you guys have not watched it, please, please, please. And Casey, let's just put it in the chat one more time. There are insights to gain, knowledge to gain, and I guarantee you, you will have 1% gains as a result of watching that. Okay, Sue, what are
I
your
know.
thoughts?
Well, I noticed a theme today. You know, the children are very little and they're worried about what's going to happen as adults. They were, three or four like that. We have to remember a couple of things. We need to give our kids the gift of time. Time does an awful lot to allow them to get their whatevers together. These kids are very asynchronous. They might be as bright as a 12-year-old and act like a 2-year-old. They're not all together yet. Executive function doesn't even all come to being till into the 20s. And just have hope there, and to remind yourselves, think about how they were last year at this time. I'm sure they're not that same child as they were last year. Have faith. And trust time and trust your good instincts. Believe in those kids. They're going to turn out okay.
Yeah, so true, so true. Zach, any parting thoughts?
Gosh, Sue just landed right on it. Honestly, this theme of time and slowing down and really trying to set all of us up for accessing patience inside of this process. And this is why I say like accessing patience, because patience is not a choice. I'm not asking people to be patient. That would be like asking you to calm down, right? It's something that we're either experiencing or not. Patience is an experience, right? So what sets us up for success for that? Because I think, I've never really met a middle schooler or a teenager who doesn't feel pressure to like figure it out, right? And so kind of to your point, what they really need is time, and to be able to borrow our confidence, borrow our patience, borrow our trust that like we're gonna figure this out. And I think, right, everybody's pursuing that. You're here, you're talking about these things, you're working on these things. So grateful that your kiddos have you as their parents, right? Such a gift, what you're offering them. And so anyways, time, yeah, such a theme today for me too.
Well, that's a perfect place to put a pin in it. Thank you so much to our experts, Susan Baum, Zach Morris. Parents, thank you for bringing the juicy questions and thank you for being here. These are good questions and you are devoting time to work through them. There is a solution for every problem and we're grateful that you're here. All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for a juicy session. Take care. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.